This is the order of battle!
Thanks for joining the Order of Battle podcast for another episode. Joel, Jason, and Sometimes A discuss collecting G.I. Joe, other 1/18 scale action figures, and in general, what sparks joy. It's a lot of things, but almost always toys. This is the Order of Battle podcast.
How's your G.I. Joe collection been going? How's your, like, have you been watching a lot of cartoons? You've been reading the comics, Alexander?
I just reread the first trade for Special Missions. And Special Missions 2 is sitting on my nightstand.
Nice. And that's the original Marvel Special Missions, right?
Uh-huh.
Not the IDW one. Nice. Those are ones I need to go back and revisit. I kept promising my listeners I was going to do it on the show, and I never made time to do it, so... Yeah, I need to do that.
You must fulfill your promises.
You're telling me. That's absolutely true. That's how we're hitting issue 155.
My question is, how many unfulfilled promises are there?
Oh, there's so many.
You gotta fulfill all of them.
I know. There's so many. I have a lot of ideas and a lot of big thoughts. And what I'm most grateful for in this world is that the people who love me and my listeners, whether they love me or just tolerate me, they're very forgiving. When a lot of my big thoughts go out in the world, and sometimes they don't always materialize. Can't beat myself up. You try not to beat yourself up, you know? I struggle with, Alexander, I struggle with sharing my creative ideas with people and then feeling bad about not doing them. Or I never share my creative ideas with anybody, and then I feel bad that I don't share my creative ideas with anybody. And my wife knows this struggle. She sees it in me all the time. And so when I open up and I share, like, hey, I had this idea to do something, and she applauds me the fact that I even opened my mouth about it. So we'll consider it a broken promise, but I look at it as positive mental health growth for Joe. Thank you. So did you read G.I. Joe 300?
No.
No, not yet. Okay. Are you saving that for, you know, like, to catch up, or is that not on your radar for now?
Not for now. I've only read up to the end of trade 20.
Okay. Do you know what issue number that is?
200, right?
Okay. So you got a little ways to go. Well, it'll be waiting for you. I just started playing that new Marvel Midnight Suns game where you play as the Marvel superheroes.
I haven't seen or heard of that one. Bruh, the only thing Marvel I've been seeing is Marvel Snap.
Oh, Marvel Snap's awesome. Oh, it's a lot of fun. Marvel Snap's a lot of fun.
I get like 80 YouTube ads every time I watch one YouTube video.
Yeah. They're really promoting the heck out of it. Yeah, they really are. But it's fun. And surprisingly, you don't really have to spend money on it. You can absolutely enjoy it without spending a lot of money. Like, without spending any money, which is nice.
Honestly, the only mobile game I'm really playing right now is Warhammer Tacticus, which that's pretty fun, but it's begging you to spend money. Like,
right. Yeah, I don't, games like that, I tend to lose interest in pretty quick.
It's fun though.
Yeah, good. Well, now if there were a G.I. Joe mobile game, what kind of game would you want it to be? I mean, there is a G.I. Joe, let's put it this way. There is a G.I. Joe mobile game. I've stopped playing it after a while.
What is it?
It's called like G.I. Joe.
War on Cobra?
Yeah. War on Cobra. Yeah, it's been a while.
The servers got shut down.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's how long ago I played it. I actually didn't realize that.
On my old iPad, I was playing it, but I wasn't like actively playing it. And once I logged in, it was like, the servers are shut down temporarily. War on Cobra 0.2 is coming out. A couple days later, searching the App Store, not there.
I didn't know that.
So it's just gone.
Good to know. Yeah, I stopped playing it a long time ago.
Honestly, I was doing pretty good.
I mean, it was fun for a bit. Got a little repetitive. I want them to do like a Call of Duty kind of game for G.I. Joe. I always thought that that's a no-brainer. And
like a mobile shooter?
Not for mobile. For like PlayStation.
Oh, yeah.
Like that kind of a game. Like that like a shooter. Like, that seems a good one. That seems...
Well, there is Operation Blackout.
Yeah, I don't know if the connection's very clear. I said a good one. Because Operation Blackout was terrible.
No, it was not.
It was terrible.
I beat it like 5 times.
You couldn't even play against anyone else online. You could only play with someone or against someone sitting on your couch. Local co-op. That's terrible. It is the year 2022.
Well, I beat it like 3 times.
There is no excuse for you not to have an online mobile versus capability.
Still. I beat it like 3 times.
Okay, congratulations.
I beat it twice on my PS4, and I beat it once on my Switch.
Congrats, you beat a terrible game 3 times.
It wasn't terrible. Just because it had awful co-op features doesn't mean it's terrible.
Well, I'm trying to be more positive lately. I really am. So I'll take it from the mouths of babes that it's not as bad as I remember it.
I prefer games that, like, give you skill levels.
Sure.
Depending on what you actually are in, you can fight people at that skill level.
That makes more sense to me.
First time playing the game against somebody who has played it, like, a billion times.
Right.
As soon as the fight starts, you're just dead.
Totally.
And they win. I've been bringing the Defiant, the Crusader, the Defiance Booster... That little ship that comes out of the Crusader.
You've been playing with that a lot lately?
And 2 other vehicles. The Stiletto.
Oh, the Stiletto. That's awesome.
And the Joe version of it. Then, Dad brought both of those. Bonus room.
Did your dad get the new G.I. Joe board games that have come out recently?
Mission Critical?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I got mine. I opened it up, checked it out. It looks like it looks a lot of fun. It looks really cool. Have you played it yet?
No.
Okay, me neither.
We haven't set it up yet.
Looks pretty great, though. I don't want to open my bonus Snake Eyes figure because I'm a sucker for the G.I. Joe card art, you know, stuff on the card. I love it. I'm a sucker for it. So I feel like I don't want to. Yeah, I feel like I don't want to open it until I know I'm going to play it. But it looks so good, though. I love it.
Yeah, we're going to open another set and paint the miniatures. Since we've been doing Warhammer.
Oh, that's great.
Well, guess I have to wrap it up.
Okay.
Bedtime sucks.
Yeah, you know, everyone's got... Listen, even Joe's have a curfew. The pit's not open 24 hours a day.
Well, it honestly should be, because what if people are out on night stealth missions?
Well, that's true. That's true.
Did they come back flat midnight?
I'm sure they make an exception.
And their spirit just snoring on the floor.
I always did kind of laugh at that, like... Spirit's the only guy. I love the idea that Spirit is so bad, you know, like so awesome. They only need him to guard that door. But like, does he ever get a break? Who takes over? Because even Spirit's got to sleep or even Spirit's got to, you know, relax and watch a movie. Like, what do they do? Who guards it when Spirit's not there? That's what I want to know. They never really address that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the idea. I just need to know the ins and outs of this stuff.
You take Spirit on a mission. Who's supposed to guard the pit?
Exactly. As soon as he goes on a mission, pit's up for grabs. Go get it. Go get it, Cobra.
And don't be fooled by the cover things again.
Yes, exactly. By like fake tents and stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Bro, that was just humiliating.
Oh my God. How embarrassing is that?
You blow up this massive chunk of land and you go get anywhere near your enemy. Easily fooled.
Also, though... You know, when I did that cover, I remember when I did that comic on the show, I really couldn't get over the fact that at that point, Cobra, to attack the G.I. Joe headquarters, had to fly over a sizable chunk of America and launch an open attack, in a United States military base in the United States, while Cobra was a sovereign nation with a seating at the UN. So the logistics of that always have been amazing to me.
Oh. There's Cobra.
Yep, that's Cobra for you. What are you going to do?
Honestly, it would be cool to recreate that.
I think they did. The movie Red Dawn. When you're a little older, you'll watch it. It's kind of the same thing. So are you open for any G.I. Joe stuff for Christmas?
Probably will.
Yeah, anything specific that you're open for?
I didn't really have anything on my list.
Oh, okay.
I gotta go.
All right, well, nice talking to you, Alexander.
Hey, he's forcing me.
Even better.
You've not met Joel before.
I don't think so.
He has not been on your show.
We can certainly rectify that.
Joel, Joe, Joe, Joel.
Hey, Joel.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, man. And Jason, do you go by Caesar Mo? Do you go by Jason?
I just go by Jason.
Just by Jason. Okay.
I don't go by King Cow. Just only on
King
yours.
King Cow, yeah, no King Cow. Okay.
Jason, Joel, Joe, Joe, Joel, Jason.
Oh my God, there's way too many J's.
This is going to be a fun night.
It's Joe, and Joel, and Jason on Joe.
The invasion of the J's.
Yes, oh my God. So many J's.
I think the Joe on Joe name is such a genius little grab. Surprising that it hasn't happened sooner.
Thank you. I love it. I've always absolutely attributed whatever longevity I've had to that name. 100%. 100%. It always catches people's eyes, ears, always gets hurt, even in non-G.I. Joe circles. You know, just you're just chatting with people. And what do you do? Podcast. And it's even if they don't know that it's about G.I. Joe, you just say Joe on Joe. They just go, oh, that's fun. You talking about Joe Biden? I'm like, no, G.I. Joe. I'm like, oh. Oh, that's even funner. Okay, yeah.
All the Joes through history? Sure.
Yeah, right.
All of them from 82 to current.
Yeah, I had the COVID masks made up with the logo, you know. I wore it a lot. And 100% I'd get people going, hey, all the time I wore it. And it was either they recognized the G.I. Joe logo or they just thought it was fun. That the name, just the words Joe on Joe on a guy's face is funny.
It's very clever. I mean, it's not as punny as What's on Joe Mind, but it's...
No, it's not.
But it is definitely punny and clever in that just perfect amount.
Now, I love a good pun, but I recognize that like half the world loves to tell you that they hate puns. You know, I feel safer without the punny title.
Sure.
And I love those guys over at What's on Joe Mind. So.
Yeah, I knew you've been on a couple times.
Yeah, they're good. Mike's good. He's, I mean, everybody, Ragtime and Joe Colton. But yeah, he specifically was he gave me a fantastic General Hawk for Columbo, my Columbo episode. So like I'm always going to be indebted because he crushed it.
That Columbo episode was perfect. I liked your behind the music, but the Columbo one I liked more because the behind the music is like you get it. It's kind of the obvious joke, but the Columbo is like you really had to go into the archives for that one.
Thank you. Yeah, I think Columbo's nearer to my heart. I think, yeah, you're right. The behind the music. I've always felt this, though, very much like you, how you describe the name Joe on Joe. And it's just sitting out there and no one took it. Doing a behind the music for Cold Slither was sitting there.
Yeah.
And it was just sitting there. As soon as I had the idea for that, I literally felt this emotional clock ticking of like, I need to get it done and I need to be as quiet about it as possible. Because as soon as, you know, like I, you know, it's a gettable idea. And so I just needed to do it and do it as fast as possible and as good as I could possibly do it. And it took about 6 months and I'm very proud of it. But yeah, it was absolutely one of those. I need to get this out before I ever talk about it publicly.
One of my old roommates who was at the time he was trying to make movies sort of independently. He used to have this saying. He said, every time you had an idea, 15 other people in the world had the exact same idea at the exact same time, and now you're in a foot race.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. He's totally right. I don't know if you guys do, you know, like how obviously you guys do creative stuff, you're podcasters, but, you know, like other, you know, if you write or draw or anything, 100% that, man. You know, I've got scripts, you know, whatever, written, half written, sketched out that sure enough, a couple years later. Here's someone's with a brand full idea. And then I look at the production schedule. I go, man, I had that idea before they ever went into production. And I never got around to finishing the script and showing it to anybody kind of a thing.
You lost the foot race.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. It's a foot race, you know, and there is something to be said also with that other principle there of you may have similar ideas, but it's how you execute it. So how do you do that idea? So there's, I truly believe in the concept of, in whatever creative medium, whether you're making comics or writing or singing or, you know, music or whatever, your version is going to be your version and you need to get it out of you as a creator because no one else can do what you do.
I also think it's part of getting a solid foothold in whatever art. I play in a bunch of bands. Once you just realize that once you just have enough self-confidence and enough of yourself together to put out a solid product of whatever it may be, like, it doesn't matter if even a band in the same town comes out with almost the essential same idea, because like what you're saying, at the end of the day, it's going to have your sound to it, even if it's essentially the same thing. That was like a very freeing thing in my early 20s when I kind of came to terms with that. Like, oh yeah, just do whatever you're going to do. Like, you know, nothing at this point in time, especially in the internet era, there isn't that much left that's original. You know, just doing enough of yourself in whatever project you're working in that you're not just directly borrowing from somebody else.
And then hand in hand with that, you just have to hold on to doing it because it's something you love. Yes. Not because it's something that you think is going to break the bank or open a million doors or whatever, because that stuff will take care of itself. You got to be prepared. You got to have, you know, you got to be ready. You got to be ready to step through those doors, certainly. But if you bank on that, you're just going to have your soul crushed. Not even considering whatever time or whatever efforts. It's literally that soul crush that's the worst. That's the hardest part to deal with. It is the setting yourself up for this is my deal breaker, and then it doesn't happen. And you just got to plow ahead and keep doing it.
Specifically in more like my hobby side of life with music, the other hobby outside of Joe's is I don't ever want to be the guy that's, because it does come off a little bit of like, bearer of bad news. But in reality, it's like the best thing that someone ever told me when I was young. But telling like a younger band, like, just stop trying to make it. You might get a small deal. You might do some stuff here and there. If your only focus is to try to quote unquote, make it, you're going to get lost. Just do what you're going to do. And if it's good enough, someone will find it to some level. You just got to continue to do stuff for yourself. And if you're genuine enough, regardless of what you're doing, people will cling to it.
And even in the, the term making it, you have the odds conversation. What are the odds of, a million people started bands and, or a million people made comic books and whatever. And, to become the number one person. Set that aside. When you become competent in a field, whether it's music or writing or podcasting or, what have you, what happens is other doors open to make your living with it. So you may end up being a successful podcast producer, right? Who makes your living in this world of podcasting that you love, or you may get a gig working your comic book. You may make a million comic books and you draw your own stuff and whatever, but somebody sees and they admire the passion, the talent, the inventiveness, but they don't like your pencils. They just think your pencils aren't as good as they should be, or they could be, and that might be very true, but they see all the other stuff. And they're looking for someone who has those capabilities because they, in their organization, they sell comic book posters, or they make action figures, and they want someone, and they just bought a comic book line. You see where I'm going with that? Mm-hmm. Where you end up making your living and making your life in a direction that you enjoy, surrounded by the things that you've put your 10,000 hours in. And I think when you don't give up, I think that's more often than not what happens. To be optimistic about it.
You're kind of in the mecca of people trying to make it.
Yeah.
Been successful in following what makes you happy, right?
Yeah. I've my job is in video games, and that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't pursued the stuff that we're talking about. Pursuing that led me to come out to California, and then I wouldn't have gotten the job that I do have that keeps the roof over my head. That also, and then my passion for comic books and my knowledge, deep knowledge of comic books, led to my job at Golden Apple. I'm their buyer. I'm just there on Saturdays, but I'm their, I'm their buyer, been there 10 years. I've met more awesome people than you forget about it. Someone's like, oh, you remember this one time that guy came in, and you're like, oh my God, I forgot about that. Or opportunities to go screenings or to go, just to whatever. It just opens doors because you're in that field, and then also meet cool people that you never realized you wanted to meet. And what that is other people in the industry that you love. It's surrounding yourself with the thing you love leads to your life's journey. I mean, look at all, let's bring it back to G.I. Joe. Look at all the great G.I. Joe fans and friends that we've all made over the years because we love this G.I. Joe hobby.
You don't really chase the toys so much as the comics, though, right?
Not in my collection, no. I've got a better than someone who doesn't collect toys collection of old stuff. but I don't collect it like I collect comics. No. I don't have that kind of space. I had a lot of the toys. I loved the toys when I was a kid, but the comics were my first and foremost G.I. Joe love.
What was your first comic book and what was your first Joe comic book?
Well, they were very, very close. So I did have some Superman stuff when I was really young. You know, I was born in 75, so you couldn't escape that 3-year-old, 4-year-old seeing Superman, the movie.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. Oh, I mean, still to this day, it's the best superhero movie they've ever made, period. So I was in love with Superman from 4 years old, you know, from a youth. So I had a handful of Superman comics and stuff. I remember when I was 7, I think first grade, I had my tonsils out. You know, my mom was like, well, let's get you something. You know, you have a surgery, parents buy you something, you know. And I asked for the Super Dictionary, which was a little bit of a fun ephemera for comic collectors. But it's a bright yellow, heavy square bound hardcover actual dictionary. It's sitting about 10 feet away from me still. It says stuff like liquid, and then it'll say L, Lex Luthor threw liquid on Superman, and then they illustrate him throwing liquid on Superman, right? And that was so seminal to my youth. That's like how I knew how to read already, but I read a dictionary when I was 7 or 8 years old, like 3 or 4 times.
That's incredible. I don't remember this. I don't remember that at all. And we're the same age. So, you know, I remember sneaking into Albertsons and reading comics off the spinner rack until getting run out. And
yeah,
that whole era of comics and, you know, buddies with older brothers who, you know, we go to their house and read the stack of comics.
Yeah, my buddy's brother was older and had a stack of Playboys.
Oh, that's better.
I don't know if it was better. I was pretty young. No, I was the only kid. I was the only kid in the comics that I knew. So fast forward a few years, and we were going to Florida. Whatever year G.I. Joe number 1 came out. So I should know that off the top of my head. What is that? 84?
No, 82.
First issue of the comic. 82. Yeah, so that issue was on the stands. We took a family vacation to Florida. So, it would have been about 7 or 8. And I remember we got that for the airplane. And because it was, yes, it was comic book size, but it was called a magazine. You know, it would have felt like a magazine.
Yeah, it was double or 1.5 thick. Yeah.
Right, right. My brain didn't associate it with the handful of floppy comics that I had at home. I thought it was a magazine. So I never looked for issue number 2. Because there was no continuing storyline. There was no see you next month. There was none of that. It was just this nice deluxe publication for G.I. Joe. And then around that time, someone got me, you know, I got into the figures and stuff. And so I was raring and going, but I wasn't reading the comic book until like probably 86, maybe. I was 11 years old then. Yeah, it was. So it would have been around issue 50 of the publication. My mother got me the digests.
Oh, I love those digests.
Yeah, they're great.
So hard to read at our age. They're so great to read.
I have to pull my glasses down and put it like an inch from my eyes, my old eyes. But yeah, I got to the digests for Easter specifically. I remember it was Easter and I loved it. And I remember realizing that they continued the stories from that one issue of G.I. Joe that I had from 3-4 years earlier. So I was like, where'd you get these? And she's 7-Eleven. So I was like, well, let's go. So we jumped in the car and we drove. We grabbed all that we could that I didn't have. I was like, I read through them. I loved them. I need to get more of these. And I remember she found a comic shop nearby, South Side of Chicago. And I distinctly remember him holding up like actual comic books and going, well, yeah, here's like G.I. Joe 51 or 48 or whatever number they were on. And I went, no, no, no. I just want these tiny ones. Like it took a little bit for me to wrap my head around, no, man, just read the ongoing stuff too. You know, like it took like a couple months of me just wanting to find all the tiny digests.
I haven't worked in a comic shop since the 90s. You're still in one.
Yeah.
But you can imagine the processing going through that guy's head.
I would have. Yes, I absolutely. So for me, I would have loved it. I would have absolutely laughed. I would, of course, corrected the child right away. I don't really recall what this guy's reaction to it was. I think he just kind of went, okay, you know, like I knew what I was talking about. We get kids in all the time. And I genuinely love helping like young kids when they're, you know, when they're with their parents and stuff, because there is this joy and wonder in helping them find something that helping him find the right book, you know, and turning him on to, like, you know, and kind of cluing him in, like, yeah, you know, your friends are going to want to read the this and this. No, you're going to want to read this book because this is the one they're not talking about. And it's awesome. And it's got the character you love in it and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, they light up. So it's a real rewarding. I don't have kids of my own. I've got a couple great dogs, but it's cool. Like, it's cool.
My local comic shop here in Nashville. So I'm from the West Coast, but now I'm 7.5 hours south of where you grew up.
Mm-hmm.
You're from out here and you're on the West. So yeah. We've swapped places. Yeah. my local shop is fantastic. It's Rick's Comic City. It's in Nashville.
Awesome.
Easily the best shop in town. They have always prided themselves on being very friendly and inclusive to whoever walks through the door.
Mm-hmm.
However, because I've been a local there for long enough and I know all the staff and I'm friends with them, some of them have been to my house, when A would come in with me, there was none of that, let me help you find the right book. It was them pestering him and him pestering them back. And I'm like, don't you guys have jobs to do? There's customers here. I'm like, yeah, but it's more fun to pick on the kid. And that's what honestly makes a great comic book experience, a shop experience, right? You've included everyone. You're welcoming everyone. You're trying to help those that are lost, those that are hopeful, and you fuck with the regulars.
I think it's a solitary hobby. You know, for all the bluster and hoopla that comic books get in movies these days, you know, when everyone's a comic expert in Marvel or DC, you know, like that, you know, all that blah blah blah. I think the origins of comic books are such a solitary hobby. It's you and your hero and these pages and the gutters of the pages, and in between, in those gutters, anything's happening. Whatever's happening in the gutters on a comic book page is only happening in your mind.
Yeah.
You know, and Jason and Joel, when you guys read a comic, what is happening in those gutters is different from what I'm reading, you know? And that's real solitary. And so I do think that's why, you know, going all the way back in the day, it attracted, you know, we'll say introverts or, you know, people who are shy or people who just, you know, weren't the belle of the ball socially. Because it was just this escape and getaway, and also the wish fulfillment aspect of it, you know, of saying, you know, I'm not super happy with whatever aspect in my life. And here you go. This book shows me a better way, shows me, you know, some kind of excitement in the world outside my window, you know, as Stan used to put it. I think that knowing that and recognizing that and being as welcome as possible to all types of people that walk in the doors of your comic shop, I think that is so important and so huge. You know, we get people of all various emotional interactive states, I would say, you know, and the only people that we have problems with are the people that are genuinely dangerous, you know, like, you know, we are in Hollywood, you know, we're you know, it's true. It's true. You know, we are in a very trafficy area of Hollywood, and you get a lot of people. There's a lot of homeless, and you get a lot of people with substance abuse issues. And even those, you know, you treat them with kindness and you treat them with kid gloves.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only the people who are jerks about it that we tend to be jerks back, you know, but we try to be real welcoming.
To take that back to G.I. Joe, I mean, that's what all communities should be, whether you have a storefront or not.
Right.
And G.I. Joe from the very beginning was teaching that through Larry, through Dixon, through Sunbow, maybe not through Deke.
Deke couldn't even get proper voiceovers. They didn't have time to teach Jack. I don't forget if we could swear on your
of
show.
But
Deke couldn't teach Jack shit. They couldn't teach their American, their Canadian voice actors how to properly pronounce sorry and about.
But they could teach 4-year-olds how to beat up Cobra Commander.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, Deke. You know, you're right, though. I'd have to do some comparisons with other ones, but it was always 100% very inclusive. You know, they talk about they purposely didn't put people of color as Cobras because they didn't want them to be bad guys.
Right.
Which is something I never realized until I was adult and going through this show. And I kind of was watching these going, wait a minute, there's no. And then I started asking that question, and that's when I found out that it was a purpose decision. I'm like, well, that's brilliant then.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
I mean, right from issue 1, they were doing this, and it was excellent.
Oh, episode one of the show. Who's this? Like the big moment of the first scene. It's Scarlet in the Sky Striker, you know, and they gave it to a girl. You know, like, that's amazing. I love that.
It's amazing for 1982 and 1984.
Exactly.
Hell, at this point, it's amazing for today sometimes. But
yeah.
So you and I are the same age, which means that I was on the southeast side of Seattle. You were on the south side of Chicago. At that time, you could take toys to school. So I'm sure you had your shit on the playground. I had mine on the playground.
Yep.
We're growing up in the same touch points. I don't know how long you kept toys in your life. I did until 15. I was already into comics. I don't know if you've heard this elsewhere or seen this elsewhere, but something about G.I. Joe was very easy to fall into X-Men.
Yeah.
So that they had a similar sort of inclusivity or mission statement. They were just really driving home certain things. X-Men and G.I. Joe were really, for me, in comics, those were my touch point. I traveled all over the place with comics, mostly kept it in Marvel or independent, not a huge DC fan, you know, but you seem to have, you're voracious on both sides of that Pepsi Coke line, as well as the independents. You have done something that it was a goal, it was a dream of mine, and I abandoned it a few years back when I didn't have the room for books anymore. But you have well and surpassed 10,000 books in your personal collection.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. I passed that. When I came home from college, I had 12,000 books. I'm at 40,000 right now.
Whew.
And have been for a few years. And I've actually really been trying to reduce that. But my intake has not. My intake has not slowed down.
Well, it doesn't help if you're the buyer for a shop.
I know. All the great books come through and I'm like, oh, I need that in my collection. Even at, like, when I say great books, I'm talking like, movie adaptations of RoboCop 3. And I'm like, oh, I need that in my collection.
Oh, my God. Darkman number 2.
Right. Oh, my God. I have Dark. I'm not joking. The six or eight issue mega series is sitting on my nightstand right now waiting to be read. I'm not even kidding.
Oh, it does not hold up. But, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah. No, I love it. Yeah. Yes, I have a lot of comic books. And that's from I really started getting into earnest at right around 12 years old, 11 years old. And I never sold them. I loved them and I treated them really well and kept them in good shape. And they've traveled with me, and so here they are, you know. So I live amongst them. Think my wife is very, very generous and very kind towards me with them.
Well, what is her collection? What is her hobby?
She doesn't have one.
What? Everybody collects something.
No, she's theater. She's theater. So she collects experiences. She collects performances. You know, she
playbills. Then
no, I mean. No, I mean, she's, you know, we have some of her memorabilia from, she ran a soap opera in Chicago for a few years, you know, like a monthly soap opera, it would play weekly. And so we've got some of that stuff. But no, as far as like the collector gene, she does not have that.
Wow.
Which is good, because we would need a lot more space in this house.
That's a bit wild.
The amount of comics you have is truly incredible. When you're honed in on a favorite series, and this isn't just, you know, obviously you have a bigger scope than G.I. Joe. So I was curious as to how far do you go with variations or alternative covers or anything in that realm?
I don't care about alternative covers. I want uniqueness. I have very few duplicates, like literally of 40,000 books, I probably have under 100 duplicates. And that is only by accident. I'm not interested in duplicate copies. If I get two, I'll find the worst. I'll keep the better one and I'll unload the worst one. I like collecting in bunches. So I developed a bad habit when I was a kid. Someone pointed this out to me probably about 10 years ago, and they were 100% right. They were like, man, you did it backwards. Like, I would collect. If I started reading, you know, let's say I have a Fantastic Four issue in front of me. So it's first one I thought of. So if I got a big chunk of Fantastic Four around, I started reading them when Simonson did his run. So what's that like? Or it was around like 340, something like that. Oh, no, actually, my first I take that back. My first FF was John Byrne stuff. That's the first FF I read. So like I got all the Byrne stuff and it was amazing. So then I was like, well, then I need to work from there. And then I need to work backwards and I need to work forward. The problem is, instead of 30 years ago going, I need to get FF number one, because 30 years ago, it probably would have been about $300.
Yes.
You know, legitimately, maybe $1,000, right? You know, instead of doing that when I was a kid, spending that much, that kind of money on a comic book was wild to me. I knew I could get more bang for my buck because I could take $20 and I could get 20 comic books versus one comic book for $20. You know, one Kirby Lee FF for 20. I could get 20 issues of John Burns or 20 issues of Simonson's and then build it up. So it's like you drop a pin where I start and you blossom that direction. So now what you end up with is a 47-year-old me with every issue of X-Men from 1976 till now, but very few before 1976. Every issue of Captain America from like 1972 until now, but very few, you know, Tales to Astonish, right? Same thing with FF. So I have these really great, huge, long runs, but I went in the wrong direction, which is how you get 40,000 comic books.
With 40,000, you can't have 40,000 key issues.
Right. Exactly. But I've got, run it down the list, you know, Cap, FF, Superman, X-Men, Legion of Superheroes, Justice League. Like, I've got these amazing runs, you know, what I consider amazing, you know, 30 years worth of those uninterrupted runs, you know, and I love it. Like, that's what my collection's all about. You know,
I think that's beautiful. When I finally stepped away from hard collecting comics, I had 12 or 13 long boxes of just X titles. And so my X-Men collection was from issue 103 to current complete. You know, all the different titles, subtitles, and everything else that had come out through then. But I didn't get anything older than 103 because it was just, that's where, as you said, the price went from like $5 or $10 a piece to $20 a piece to $100 a piece. Right. And you're like, oh, shit.
Right.
I think for me, the Ultimate Universe messed me up because I loved it so much that I quit reading 616.
Oh, yeah.
And then Ultimatum happened and they were like, listen, we just want Miles. We're going to get rid of the rest.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, now I have six long boxes of the entire 1610 universe. Its value went to nothing. And I'm trying to read them. Oh, I'm trying to read them on my second or third pass. And I'm like, you know what?
There's wildly little value in those original Ultimate comics. The weird part about it, actually, I'll say this, is hold on to your Spider-Mans because of the Miles stuff, too. But sure. Also the early Ultimates, that was when Marvel was in bankruptcy. So the print runs on those were very small. So I'm surprised that some of those really haven't.
Well, Ultimate Spider-Man 5 was like, I mean, that print run was crazy low. It was a very hard book to find and extremely expensive for being a number five.
Right.
I cleaned house. I got rid of all of my comics except for G.I. Joe and a friend has to work on it. Otherwise, I stick with the trades.
I certainly have a fair amount of trades in my home, but I do not collect trades. I don't read trades. I don't read monthly trades. I read like omnibus collections. I get those because that's kind of been my latest jam of looking at some of the vintage, you know, like some of the classic runs, like the Lee Kirby FF, and just going like, well, realistically, am I ever going to, you know, I've got a few of those, but am I ever going to fill in all 100, you know, 104 issues or whatever it was? Like, no, that's not going to happen. So I just get the omnibus because I do want them in print. You know, I don't like reading digitally.
I don't either. I think it's a thing of growing up with comics your whole life, I collect books still, and it's a very hard thing for me to sit down and read digitally.
Well, it's also, I think that's the primary thing. I think you're right. I think it is a generational thing, but it is also the medium wasn't made to be read backlit.
True.
Pages were colored and everything was designed to be lit. And when you read digitally, it's backlit and it gives it a different look. Also, when I read digitally, it, you know, it's got the zoom, the panel to panel zoom, just to literally to make it legible and stuff. And I don't panel to panel storytelling on the most vintage stuff. It just doesn't encompass the whole page. I love the page as a piece of art.
Yes. 100%.
Yeah. I think there's so much storytelling on a page and leads you to the next page that the purest form obviously is the original printing, because then you're also dealing with those artists for the most part. You know, at a certain point, they understood where their commercial breaks were going to be, you know, where the ads were. So they would know where to put cliffhangers and things like that. A well-made book, well put together book would. Yeah. So I do think it is a different experience. Yeah, but now you're getting new people that are designing for the digital experience. And so the storytelling, that language is changing and learning. That might be a little get off my lawn then, you know, because I don't enjoy that language as much.
I'm willing to embrace it as much as I can. But for me, it's, yeah, there's something about holding paper in my hand.
I agree.
And you're right. I hadn't thought about the whole page break reveal or the page turn reveal in terms of the ad breaks, because it was a whole different thing before the average consumer started learning the language of comic books and knew what a page turn reveal was and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think another aspect as well is, so specifically if it was on a phone or a tablet, it's so hard to stay on task.
Yeah.
When I jumped back into collecting the G.I. Joe figures, I knew that there was a huge, massive comic run. It was not anything that I had from my childhood or anything like that. So I very, you know, a different generation of Joe and a different style of collecting than most of my peers. But I mean, like, I had a handful of X-Men and Ghost Rider and Spider-Man and just random, like, whatever junk comics I could get my hands on. So I knew that I wanted to get into Larry's original run. I had humored the idea a few times of trying to just, you know, I'll just do it digitally, you know, like whatever. And every time I tried to like look at it on my computer or on my phone, I could not get myself to do it. And it just, it would have saved me a lot of money because I collected just the IDW trades. I tried so hard. And then even too with some of the Battle Action Force and the UK stuff, there's no way I'm going to hunt that stuff down. But I would try to go on to, you know, Blood for the Baron has like a you know, an archive where everybody's colored the stuff in and all that. And it's like, it doesn't, you know, I don't have a more in-depth response to that. But as a younger person, I can say that there's just something about in my brain, if I'm supposed to read a book or a comic book, like I need it to be in my hand. And it just doesn't translate well to me in a digital screen.
I agree so much, you know, so much with all that. And you're talking about printed pages, artists, it's even absolutely including digital artists today. So it's not meant as a slam on artists of today, but like artists, they knew what the output was going to be. So they knew how much detail they could or should put into the page because it's going to be, you know, not literally not picked up by the printer. So they look different because they were drawing to them. They were drawing to the medium that the output was going to happen in. And so digital artists do the same thing as well. And so that's why I think, yeah, when it's designed for the output medium, it's always best in the output medium it was designed for.
I'll relate to music. A lot of the times when, you know, certain records that have been out of print for a long time that people really want, you'll have people that'll bootleg them. And what a lot of people don't understand is that a record has to be mixed and formatted a certain way to sonically sound even remotely decent in the vinyl format. I've even seen it now on like I'm using this phrase lightly, but like a legal bootleg where a company will reach out to the European version of whatever record label and throw them money to get the quote unquote rights to press the record, and then, you know, European Warner Brothers sends them an MP3 file and they send it off and press it, and then the record comes in and it is almost unlistenable, truly, because it's not, you know, and that would obviously translate the same with someone who drew a page specifically for paper and vice versa. You know, if you take something that's hyper digital and hyper detailed and you don't have a printer of that quality and you try to print it, it does not look good.
Yeah, well, I mean, so it's two, you're 100% right. And then that makes me think of two subjects. One, I'll jump into this real quick, but with modern digital drawing and digital coloring techniques, a lot of the art styles that are getting printed are they're not doing a lot of black holds, right? So it's just color on color on color to define the image that you're seeing, which works really brilliantly in a digital space and can work to some effect on printed page. I don't like it on the printed page. I like a traditional pencil with black inks delineating the forms and then color, you know, accentuating that. That's just, but that's a generational thing. I'm not saying that, you know, one's better than the other,
sure.
But you get that with digital, because online you can imagine a lot of those colors just pop and make the form glow better because you're getting it on a digital frame. And then related to that, talking about working for the medium, old comics pre-80, early 80s, we'll just say, and even up through the early 80s, really, they technically weren't colored by the people that are credited as coloring. The colorists from back in the day, and that's not taking anything away from them, it's just the process of it. They would put the color guides in there, and they would say, paint green goblins, you know, this is the color green you use on this, and this is the color purple you use on this, this is the color red you use here on Spider-Man. And they would spot the colors. They would give that guide to the printer, and they literally were printed by some schmo at the printing house, literally. And that was just the process of it. So some dude at the printing house would get this color guide put together by an absolute artist and you know, a creative person. And then they would then translate it into what the printing press would roll out. So there's this loss in translation element to a lot of that stuff. And I'm not even talking about the random error, you know, when Spider-Man's in a purple suit or whatever, but just the general quality of it was a bit of a beautiful Frankenstein's monster, you know, because you do have this translation between typically someone who's not considered an artist being the printer guy and then the actual artist, the colorist. But then when you get into the digital era of coloring in the early 80s, when they could do it more directly from the colorist's actual colors, then you start talking about books like Watchmen and you start, you know, in those books that really are, they weren't yet at digital using computers, they weren't yet at digital printing, but they were actually being colored by the actual colorists. So now you're talking about current printings of those books. We're like three levels into this. When they recolor those books, right? So they do, oh, we've recolored, you know, V for Vendetta or Miracle Man. They've recently recolored Miracle Man. I don't want to see the recolored Miracle Man. I want the original colors of the Miracle Man. However, when they recolor something, for example, Kirby, they did a couple times they released it, Kirby's Tales from Asgard stuff, where they collect just those 8-page backups. And they've recolored those because the original colorings were, you know, iffy. Those look brilliant because the original colors, you know, were what we just described, right? So it's how they talk about when they curate movies and they curate films. You have to have someone in the room that knows what they're dealing with. And just updating it to make it as crisp, you know, to make Citizen Kane as crisp as possible isn't necessarily the best thing for it, because there's a certain level of fuzziness that Orson Welles intended. You know what I mean?
That's fantastic.
I think there's absolutely something to be said about enjoying something in the way it was supposed to be enjoyed from the era it was supposed to be, or when it was created to be enjoyed. Even besides just a personal preference, like just getting the original thing the way it was originally intended to be viewed, even if there is a massive error in it, it's still magic because that's what it was. I can relate more into some of these more finite details into more of the music stuff that I'm really deep dived into. But like, there's a Blue Oyster Cult song. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but it's one of their major hits. And at the end, and right when the song starts to fade out, there's a kick drum hit that is just like off. You know, and this is back in the time of being recorded on reel. You know that they were in there. They're in the studio. That offbeat came at the end. You know somebody got motherfucked. But then they were just like, the engineer was probably like, guys, don't worry, it's in the fade out. Once somebody pointed that out to me, every single time I hear the song, I hear it. I like it now. It's funny to me. I don't ever want to hear that song without the off kick. And it's like, it wasn't like an avant-garde thing. It was literally just, yeah, you hit that a beat off.
Beatles songs are full of that. Full of it. Where they, you know, Ringo hit a wrong beat or Paul played something, and Beatles, and you know, the Beatles. Yeah, it's the beauty of imperfection. It's, you know, it's why some of the people they say are like the most beautiful people in Hollywood. When you actually look at their face, there's something that's not right about it. But it's because it's just a little imperfect that just makes it charming. Yeah. If there's anyone that ever hears this, if there's one person that hears this interview and hears this podcast, I want it to be George Lucas.
Perfect. We'll send it right over. We're actually going to put it on vinyl.
But we're not going to use the right audio format. It's going to be really impossible to listen to.
You know, the one thing that I do have to complain about being a Gen X comic book person is I can no longer just lay on my stomach on the floor surrounded by comics for 45 minutes and read.
Yeah, because my back hurts. Yeah.
So the reason why I was really excited to have you on now that we've been talking for over an hour was this. This is perfect. With all the comics you have, what drew you to doing Joe on Joe, other than the catchy name, but focusing on G.I. Joe? Well, you didn't start with the comics. I'm sorry. That's not true. You started with the cartoon.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that because it was the catchy name, actually, that sealed the deal. I was a podcast producer out here. I produced a couple storytelling podcasts, one called Storyworthy, which is fabulous, still going on. Christine.
I'm familiar.
Yeah, they're great. I was their producer for a couple of years. It was when I first moved out to California. There was an ad saying, looking for a podcast producer. I listened to so many podcasts when they, like, I was a Corolla, like, day one listener. I can't listen to him anymore. But
sure.
I was a Corolla day one listener. Yeah, I listened to Kevin Smith way before they did Smod Castle, and it was just Kevin in a microphone. You know, I loved it. And my friend Matt turned me on. He's like, "Hey, do you hear they're doing this? Like these things called podcasts?" And I was like, "What?" It's all I wanted to listen to. So I was really well versed in it, but I didn't never, you know. So they were looking for a producer. So I went, "I'll help." You know, like I'll be a PA guy. So I just would go to Christine's house every, I think it was Thursday nights, every Thursday night, and just sit and 100% just sit in and be a PA and sit and help. And I got to meet some cool people. She knows a ton of people like in Hollywood. So she always is cool people. I met people that I didn't realize until years later how cool they were, because I was just new to the scene and new to, you know, understanding that not everyone you meet is going to be Harrison Ford. Like there's so many cool people that are operating at that single A level of being a fantastic entertainer. And so you really need to keep your head on a swivel. But it was awesome. And so I interned with her for a couple of years, I think. And then eventually, you know, you technically became her producer and just helped her get the show together, you know, and use some of the skills that I brought from my life in marketing. And this is a tip for people. You know, I'd worked in email marketing and digital marketing for a few years. And so those were the skills I brought to the table. So I said, you know, just made some suggestions to her as far as like the behind the scenes part of the show of saying, "Hey, I think you should do this a little different. And what if we made your website this and did that, blah, blah, blah." And then that really helped her grow the show. And so it was great. And then they were awesome. Her and Hannes at the time was her co-host. And they were great. And they've become great friends and all that. So I produced that. And then from there, other people saying, "Hey, I want to do a podcast." And so I was like, absolutely. Just saying yes to things. Saying, "Yeah, I'll help you. I'll help you do a podcast." And I didn't know how to do it. I just knew how to sit in a room and watch other people do it. So I figured that out. And we started producing other people's podcasts. So I did that for a few years and it led to me going, "Well, I want to be on the mic," because I wasn't on the mic. But
and you've got a good voice.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And I've performed, you know, I've done stuff. I wasn't in front of the camera for this stuff. I said, "Well, I need something that I can do solo." And originally the show, the first 15 episodes was just me watching it. I needed something I could do solo because I hate scheduling. I hate it. And I didn't have a partner in crime for this venture. It's just something that I wanted to do. And I thought if 10 people hear it, great. I'll have fun doing it. You know, it's you know, whatever. So then I started thinking about like, okay, watch alongs. Like I want to do a watch along. And I started thinking about all the things that I love because I have a sizable DVD collection and, you know, shows. And I was like, "Man, I never watched these. Like, I should totally just watch some of these." And so I was like, "Well, Batman, there's like 1800 Batman podcasts. You know, I'm like, I got a Superman, there's a million Superman podcasts." And I went, "G.I. Joe. I haven't watched my G.I. Joe DVDs in forever." And I Googled it. And the only podcast, and God bless him, because Steven's become a friend and I love him. He's my Zartan, Steven Jubber. Yeah. The only podcast that popped up at the time was G.I. Joeberg. And I looked at it and I went, South Africa. And they hadn't at that point, when I Googled it, they hadn't updated it in a couple months or something. This goes, you know, go back 8 years. And I was like, no one's doing a G.I. Joe podcast. So that's as far as I look. And I said, all right. So I shared it with my buddy at work and we were talking. And then I just spent the rest of the day at work, my actual job, just thinking of names for the show. And when the words Joe on Joe jumped in my head, I turned to my friend Angel and said, hey, what about Joe on Joe? Anyway, that's the one. He's just pointing at me. He's like, that's it. And I said, oh, shit, I got to do this now. If I don't do this, it'll bother me forever. So within a week, all my domains were registered and my social handles were set up. And then it took another month or two to really get it actual in production.
That's fantastic. Yeah, Steven is great.
Great.
He and A have taken over our show a couple of times, just the two of them.
Awesome.
A and I both have been on their YouTubes a couple of times. He's a lot of fun. He's good people.
Yeah, he's such a positive energy for the stuff. Yeah, it's really, really dynamite. So, yeah, it's great.
So you're going through the cartoon. You start bringing in guests. This is how you and I met, because you were getting close to the end of the Deke era when you said, when I heard you say, hey, you know, like, we've only got a few left. If you want to be on here, why not? And at the time, I was wanting to podcast, but I had no real knowledge of how. And I started showing up on other people's podcasts and went, all right, I'll just email you. What do I have to lose? And you were like, all right, come on, like 2 weeks from now. Oh, shit. Well, now I know what I have to lose. It was a lot of fun. And then I came back for G.I. Joe Extreme. You know, you kindly let Alexander come on as well. Yeah. For at least a few minutes. And then began a small dialogue. And we've wanted to do this for a while, but it's somewhere along the line, you had the comic book side of it behind your Patreon wall.
Yeah.
And after Deke and after Extreme, instead of jumping straight into Spy Troops or Valor versus Venom or any other cartoons, you've just stuck with the comics as your main thing. And now you've hit 155, or you're just about to hit 155.
Yeah. You know, what you're describing is various stages of burnout. Is what you're describing, really. So when I finished Deke, I was burned out. Like, it was a lot.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I really, I hit one thing that was always been instilled in me from childhood through like my high school football coach is like work ethic and consistency. And so like I, you know, like never missed a Wednesday, you know, like it wasn't like a casual, oh, when I get an episode up, we'll put it. It was, no, I got to publish. It's Wednesday. I got to publish. So when I hit the end of DIC, I was just burned out. Took a break and it went a little longer, I think, than I thought it wanted it to be. But then COVID happened. And then I was like, well, we're all stuck at home. One, I don't know how many listeners are still plugged into my show, but might as well. Let's do a re-release of all the original episodes. And then that led me to go, well, let's just finally jump into doing Extreme, which I fell in love with Extreme.
Oh, it's so good.
It really is good. It is good. The animation suffers from money, but the show is good.
It also suffers from the time period where everything was indeed extreme.
Extreme. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so that kind of reignited it. And I just needed to recharge batteries. But when I started the Patreon about towards the middle of that first run, that was just to, you know, it's to just to help keep, you know, literally keep paying the bills on the show, you know, trying to get the show to pay for itself, which is a goal. I think that's a doable goal for most podcasters, you know. I don't make money on it, but it's, you know, it's like I'm not getting rich on it, but it pays for itself and it's great. And I'm so grateful for all the Patreons that we have. But like when I originally set it up, I actually had loftier goals. I had it was right around after I did Cold Slither. And I was like, and I think it's still on there. I think it's still on there as a goal, then I'll do it. But if it was like, if I can get X amount of dollars a month, then I'll do live scripted radio plays of G.I. Joe every 3 months, you know, which is which is somewhere in me. That's in me, you know. It's just to do that, that means I have to start paying performers, you know, and then all that stuff. So that's an infrastructure that has to
be. You have enough podcasters, you could probably just start rounding up people that sound okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a part of the goal. And then I did the Joe and Joe Illustrated. That's another thing that I love about the brand is that I can go call it Joe and Joe Theater. That's the Cold Slither, and Columbo falls under that category. And my Special Missions falls under that category. And then I can do Joe and Joe Illustrated, which is me talking comic books, and then just straight up Joe and Joe. And then when I do, if I ever interview like actual celebrities, it's what do I call it? I've only done a couple of them. It's called like Joanne Joe Hall of Fame or something like that. I forget what I call it. So I started doing the illustrated, and my passion for the comic book part of it really came out. And I loved it. And I would sit at my so the early ones were just for the Patreons. And every fifth one I would release on the main feed so that people got a flavor for it, you know, maybe come over to the Patreon. So the first
I remember this.
Yeah. So like the first 50, I think 40 of them are still behind the paywall of Patreon. It just unlocked channels, you know, like this. We've been talking comics for over an hour. Very little G.I. Joe stuff because I love talking comics. I love the language of comics. It's my 10,000 hours. That's what I wanted to contribute back to the collective consciousness.
We've been talking like this for over an hour because the whole scope of our podcast is to just bullshit about the things we like. Mm-hmm. There's no real show so much as it's a conversation. And we've been accused more than once of being a little over enthusiastic about what we enjoy. And I will take that complaint all day long.
If you can't do that on a podcast, what good's a podcast for?
In today's world, I mean, we would have triple the listeners if we just complained about things. You know what's wrong with G.I. Joe today?
Yeah.
It's not my speed.
Right.
So I remember when it was behind the paywall and you were doing this, and I've been listening for a while. I enjoy the Joe on Joe experience.
Thank you.
I enjoy the very truthfulness about when you just don't know, and that's fine. You still love G.I. Joe, but you don't have the 100% minutia knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
You're just like, I'm probably wrong. It's fine. Move on. And I love that because you're not being the expert of G.I. Joe. You're being the expert of bringing us the comic book in a deep dive form. And when I first started looking for G.I. Joe comic or G.I. Joe podcasts, you found Joburg. I found several we're going to go through every issue of the comic book G.I. Joe podcast, and none of them made it past like 21-30. None of them. And I was always disappointed. I'm like, well, there's 20 episodes here and they haven't published in 3 years, so I guess I'll skip this one. When I noticed you were getting close to 155, to me this is celebratory. I mean, one, you know, we've always had good interactions, so you're somebody I could have on the show that I'm not going to regret. Also, I like your show a lot, and I think this is a really neat thing. Getting through all of Sunbow was cool. Getting through Deke was impressive in a feet on the hot, you know, hand on the hot stove sort of way.
Masochistic kind of way, sure.
Getting through Extreme was excellent because I know some people that are some Joe people that are very into Extreme, but by and large Extreme is forgotten or just assumed to be awful because the figures are
bad. Yeah, not necessarily the design but the execution.
Right. As much as I love G.I. Joe, to me, like, I had the comic books, I read them when they came out, the G.I. Joe Extreme comic books. But they were disposable to me. I don't remember them that well. So you brought it back into my forefront and gave me a door to introduce it to A, you know, and the whole Extreme.
Extreme!
It's fucking great.
My wife hates that. She's in the other part of the house. And I know she can hear me. Yeah, she hates whatever. Yeah, she knows. She always hears it. She hates that scream.
40,000 comic books cannot deaden the sound.
No, it really can't.
I'm being very long-winded here, but I'm just kind of fanning a little bit and why, like, we wanted to.
That's very kind.
Just sit around and bullshit with you.
Very kind, man. I love it. I'll do it anytime. Yeah, it's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah, and 155, like, I've read all 155 at least twice. I've read the first, you know, 40 or 50 probably a dozen times, and then it starts to fall apart after the Civil War, and there are parts that are great and parts that aren't. The last 50 are not awesome. I mean, they're okay. There's some gems in there, but I'm not a big fan of, like, Wildman's art, and I'm not a big fan of some of the other artists, or at least back then. I'm sure his art's fine now. But there was a lot of the artists in those last 20 that were just, they're just, I'm not a fan of. And I don't think in today's world they ever would have got work. But in that early 90s, it was, I mean, you were really pushing that stylistic.
Sure.
Yeah. Versus you were walking away from the classics, the masters, and you were really driving hard that stylism. which is how Liefeld and all these others really came into power.
We all love Herb Trimpe. And if you Google or go on your Marvel Unlimited apps or, you know, talk about digital comics or look up any of the Fantastic Four Unlimited comic books, Herb Trimpe drew them. Herb Trimpe of G.I. Joe, of Hulk fame. Like, his Hulk is gorgeous. G.I. Joe stuff's great. His Hulk is gorgeous.
Trimpe was a master.
But look at his FF Unlimited. And I say,
oh, yeah,
I say he's a master because he did this. He adapted to what the style was at the time. And you look at it and on its surface, you go, oh, that's atrocious. But he was doing what was selling.
Yes.
And that's how good of an artist he was, that he took his, however, at that point, 44 decades of drawing comic books. And he said, this is what the current trend is, which is, I think, what we're talking about in G.I. Joe, how everything was kind of getting to that image style. And he changed his beautiful renderings to this image look. And it's rough to look at.
But it kept him paid.
It kept him paid. And it also shows how brilliant and diverse of an artist he really was. I really have a lot of respect for that. But yeah, that is what was going on with G.I. Joe. I've told this story on my show a few times, and actually it's a reminder I need to, I'll probably do it at 155. I'll share it again. So I was in college and I stopped reading. I think I must've stopped at either 150 or 151.
That's a very common stopping point for a lot of people back then. Yeah.
Yeah. And, because it was just too much. It was too much. It was too starring Snake Eyes. It was too, you know, extreme. It was too all of that.
It was a Murder House Ninja.
And even now, if you hear my recent episodes, man, they keep going back to Destro's Castle. I'm like, oh, my God, I don't care about Destro's Castle and the fact that it transforms. I don't care. So I stopped reading it. 4 months later, it canceled. My theory, this is putting me at the center of the universe. My theory has always been for 25 years, 30 years. Sales figures were about 3 or 4 months lagging, right? So, you know, there's a tipping point, right? Whatever the number is, if it's 10,000 copies, they go, okay, if we're above 10,000, we're making money. If we're at 99.99, we're losing money and we're killing it. So my personal theory is that I was number 99.99. As soon as I stopped reading G.I. Joe, my subscription got killed and they dropped below that threshold. And 4 months later, 155 hit the stands and was the end of it. I was taken by surprise when I saw it. When I learned that 155 was the end of G.I. Joe, I did not get it off the stands. I picked it up that summer after it or whatever, you know, whatever the next con I went to. I picked it up as a back issue because I just didn't know they stopped publishing it because I had dropped it about 4 months earlier.
So not solipsistic at all, right?
No, not at all. It's my fault. I take complete blame. It's my fault.
Yeah, it was a rough and tumble end, but we have talked, Joel and I have talked to Vinny, who was one of the brand managers of Joe's in the 90s, and he was telling us about how as Stephen Hasselfeld died and Alan Hasselfeld took over, there was a little bit of a loosening of certain restrictions around what could and couldn't be put into a toy. And as children, the child generation was changing, not like the American generation of 17 years or the dictionary of 33, but just, you know, as the child generation changes every 5 to 10. Even the children of, you know, are the G.I. Joe godfathers. They're the A-Raw godfathers. You know, even their kids are like, oh, G.I. Joe's boring. It doesn't do anything. So they started adding in missiles and things like that. To which I said, you know, like you being a kid of 75, I went, G.I. Joe did everything without finger flick technology or spring-loaded weapons. It did everything. But that's, you know, that's your generational change of children. You know, as you're getting into the extreme era and the turtles and everything else, Joe's didn't do what those other things did. We started chasing, and then you start getting this weird stuff in the comics and everywhere else. And nowadays, looking backward, I love it. I love all of it. I collect all the stuff from the 90s that as a teenager I didn't. I still struggle with the artwork in those later issues of Joe's, but I love having them. And I love your deep dive. And you're not the only podcast now that's gotten to 155, but you're the only one doing it issue by issue.
Thank you.
Talking Joe's is a great podcast. They were doing it by storyline. I loved listening to them all the way through 155 and all the way into catching up. I loved being on and talking about one of the issues with them. But I haven't seen anybody else do the single solitary one-to-one all the way through 155 other than you. And I've enjoyed it.
Oh, man, that means the world to me. Thank you. I genuinely did it, decided to do that, not do it like by grouping or by or even a general review, you know, like talk about the comic but literally going page by page by it was my choice because, again, a respect for the medium. That's how much I love comic books. The guys, even in the Image stuff, you know, even the stuff that were, you know, that we say wasn't as great as some of the other stuff, those dudes still loved what they were doing. They worked really hard on it. They spent 30, you know, production on a comic's roughly 30 days. They spent, you know, if you do a page a day, you're spending 22 days, 25 days out of your month on those pages. And so I think there's, even in some of the more maligned issues, there's always a level of craftsmanship that you can pull from that. And you do. And I've just been able to see so much beauty in a lot of these books that were formerly dismissive, and references, you know, to whatever pop culture stuff, but storytelling techniques and the way they've done the page layouts, and not every page, you know, not every page, and frankly, not every book. Some books I realize, like, I'll get through it and I'll realize that I pretty much just did a page recap. And I always try, my goal is to at least stop and smell the roses on at least three pages of the 22 pages, you know, to really dig into it and really go, okay, wow, here's what they're doing. And if you look at the shapes and the forms on the page, not necessarily the actual drawings, but just the forms they're using, you know, they create this visual zigzag that brings your eyes across the page, like that kind of a deep dive thing. I try to do it in at least three or four pages. Which doesn't sound like a lot, but it ends up being a lot, because then the rest is the rest is like recap and summary, and I don't want to be here for 2 hours.
Sure.
But, you know, and you do, you sometimes you get through an issue and you're like, man, there really wasn't anything that stood out for me there. And I never take that as a slam on the book. I take that as a slam on me. I take that as a, man, I didn't take the time to really, because all these dudes are so talented, and they lived with this stuff for a month. You know, I can give them 45 minutes, you know.
To your point, even something like Talisman from Image, like looking back,
oh, yeah,
we can pan it all day long, but we all bought the shit out of it.
Yeah.
You can say how much you hate Liefeld today, because it's very good to hate him, but I guess I'm not a fan of his work, but it's, yeah, I don't have to go around bashing him like everyone does. I'm just saying, like, it's very vogue to do it now, but I bought his shit like hand over fist when he was brand new, just like everyone else.
Yeah, totally. And I don't know that I have the emotional energy to go through that early Image stuff like that, because there was a lot of it. There was a dearth of storytelling, and there was a dearth of, you know, conveyance. And I think the, you know, every generation learns from the prior.
I think one of the things that really for comic book art, the time where I realized that I was growing in discernment and in experience and everything else, and it's okay to love something that may not hold up, is I was always a big fan of Silvestri.
Yeah.
But when I went back and I looked at those first couple issues of Witchblade, the younger teenage girl was the exact same shape, just shrunk. It was like you took the same image and you just reduced one by 30%.
Sure.
And I was like, oh my God, this is awful.
Yeah.
And then I had to stop myself of like, why do I think it's awful when I loved it then?
There's an energy. I know what you're talking about with Silvestri, man, but there's an energy to his stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And an underlying understanding of anatomy and storytelling.
But and that was then. His stuff was evolving just like I was evolving. But, you know, he was just doing it in public.
Right. He's got a new Batman book out now. I think not to cost, because I enjoy him. One, I've met him a couple times in person. Very nice. Always very nice. I think his eyesight or something is on the wane.
Ouch.
Or the wax. Yeah. So I think that's been part of why we haven't seen a ton of output from him.
Sure.
But his new Batman book looks wild and so much fun. I want to pick it up and see it. I'll probably get that in a collection, because he had a story like his X-Men. His X-Men were the first main X-Men that I read. I started with Simonson's X-Factor, and Simonson, we could do another 4 hours on how much I love Simonson. But it I loved X-Factor. So then that led me to X-Men, and it was right at the Inferno. So I was learning the language of comics really through Mark Silvestri and Walter Simonson.
Beautiful.
And G.I. Joe, you know, which I think would have been Rod Wiggum at the time. So that's literally who taught me how to read comic books. So, yeah, I got a great respect. I don't ever really think of Silvestri in my top favorites personally. But as far as like respect for like his X-Book stuff, and I didn't follow him over to his Image stuff, but his X-Book stuff is just so there's so many iconic things that he did in it during that era. You know, it paved the way for a Jim Lee. I don't think you get to Jim Lee as a style of a book. Not saying that Jim Lee as a character, as a creator, wouldn't have gotten there without Silvestri. I'm saying as the book, Romita Jr. to Silvestri is a natural progression to Jim Lee. You know, I think it's like the entree, you know, like they were setting us up with those guys as they were getting a little more abstract, a little more imagey. Yeah. And then here you go, Jim Lee, and then it blows the doors off.
I loved JRJR.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, all through the 90s. And that's what I mean is like it's easy to look back at John Romita Jr. Punisher in the 90s and be like, well, it looks blocky. You know, that's fine. You know, I loved it all day long. I'll take it.
He's really high on my list of people that I see young kids or modern, quote unquote, comic fans slagging on his stuff. And I go, you don't understand.
Right.
You may what you might be doing is what I did to Kirby in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
When I first saw Kirby stuff, I was seeing his superpower stuff and I wasn't getting it. It just didn't. It wasn't there for me. And I was like, everyone talks about this King Kirby. What am I looking at? You know, and then you start getting the reprints of his real stuff, you know, of the early FFs. And you go, oh, I was stupid. And I would want to go back and slap the 14-year-old me who was dismissive of it. I remember a conversation with my friend Stu, and it was me saying, like, I like John Byrne's version of the thing best because it's the best. And you know, and I love John Byrne's drawing, don't get me wrong. But I was like, oh, John Byrne's thing's the best. And Stu was like, Kirby. And I was like, what? And Stu would just educate me. And now I look back and I go, oh, yeah, of course, Kirby. Of course, Kirby. And Burns is great, but of course, Kirby.
Oh, yeah, Burns is amazing, but of course, Kirby. Kirby is one of those. That's one of the things I like about Kirby is he's accessible enough that you can go, okay, I get it. But he's deep enough where a couple years later, you're like, oh, I get it.
Kirby is a typewriter. Kirby is a typewriter. You absolutely understand the font. You understand the words, and it is accessible to everyone else, you know. And then someone like a Neil Adams comes along and they're writing in cursive and you go, oh, that's pretty. And if you read cursive well, you go, oh, wow, that's brilliant. And that's great. And you really does great stuff. But cursive doesn't exist without that handwritten block style, you know, typewriter.
I've mentioned Talking Joes and you. And I don't know if you've listened to any of the Anything Joes, which our friends Greg and Jaren, they've been going through the comic books one by one. They've been hiring voice actors to do some of the voices.
Amazing.
In the panel. And it's great.
Amazing. You want to know a dirty secret? And please, for any of you fellow podcasters that are listening, this is not personal. I do not listen to other G.I. Joe podcasts. I do not listen to any of them unless like I'm on them. And that is 100% because I don't want to steal from them. So I'm friendly and I've, you know, met you guys and like I've said, the joke, I when I'm on their shows, I'll listen or I'll give a listen to a previous episode to get jived up for the show. So I know what it's all about. I don't want to steal. And I know my brain is such that I want everyone's show to be unique and special and awesome. So I celebrate all of them. Like I retweet and there's room for all of us, but I don't listen.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. I want to keep my intentions pure.
I listen to all of them because I spent so many years by myself as a G.I. Joe person.
Uh-huh.
To the point that I thought that I was the only one that remembered G.I. Joe.
Oh, yeah.
And never considered getting online and looking for a G.I. Joe community because I've always lived in large cities. I mean, I've spent time in small towns, but by and large, most of my life's been in large cities and I've never had a G.I. Joe person in my life ever. And so I never looked for anything. So as soon as I found there was a community, I'm like, I'll watch every YouTube. I'll listen to every podcast. I'll read every blog. I don't worry about the stealing part because we're just having conversations here. We're just bullshitting around. but you have a good show, and so I get that.
Well, so that's the thing. I steal from other podcasts. They're just not J.I. Joe podcasts. I'm not even joking. I find phrases, turns of phrases that I've incorporated into my own podding language. I've gotten those from other shows. Some segment bits ideas that when my show was a little more produced, heavier. I totally cribbed that from like a movie podcast that I used to listen to. So it is because it seeps in and you don't realize you're doing it until you're doing it. And then I go, well, I just might as well do it because, you know.
On a broader note about podcasts, when you've spent hundreds of hours sometimes listening to people talk, every once in a while you have to remind yourself that you're not friends with those people. I find myself thinking I'm on an inside joke between two people on a podcast that I've listened to, 400 plus hours of. I don't know these people in real life.
Did you guys ever listen to the Gilbert Gottfried Amazing Colossal podcast?
No. I did not listen to that one.
One, they're still running them. They're still accessible. I urge you to. If you love like old Hollywood or just random old movie monster stuff, like ephemera, like non-comic book, really. Occasionally they touch on comics. But the way that format and the casualness and the friendliness of that show, exactly what you were just talking about, Joel. I felt like I was best friends with Gilbert Gottfried and Frank Santopadre. I felt like I knew them. When Gilbert died, it was like losing a friend. 100% what you're saying there. And because I thought it was a well-run show.
I just wonder, like, what could possibly be the next evolution of a podcast?
VR. Yeah, like VR hangouts. Something like that, I don't know. Once we figure it out, though, be one of the forerunners on it. That's how you make your name, you know? I don't know. I think like AMAs, like Reddit AMAs, come close to that next level of interaction, you know, where it's live. It's the person. They're doing it right there. You have access to them. And a lot of podcasts do it now when they broadcast live, like the guys at What's on Joe Mind, you know, they go live a lot and they have the chat running. And
that's what Joe Berg and What's on Joe Mind are exclusively doing now. And I think Full Force to some part is also exclusively or very close to exclusively doing that. We have not gotten to that point. I am not a visual watching kind of. I love movies. I love video games. I love cartoons. I just don't sit down with it enough. So I struggle with YouTube and it's never the forefront of my mind, even though it's clearly the way that a lot of podcasts are going. One, it's much easier to edit. I spend hours editing.
If I had a dope office with a dope background, I probably would have been on YouTube by now. But my office is very workman. I got comic boxes and eBay boxes and, you know, it's not a very attractive backdrop. So
now that you've hit 155, you talked about burnout after finishing Deke, although you did muscle through and do Extreme and you were rewarded. Extreme was awesome. You've hit 155. Are you muscling through to 200?
No. Mm-mm. I'm putting down Joe Illustrated for a bit for a couple of reasons. One, I wouldn't jump right back into like 155 and a half because I, this may sound heretical, enjoyed the Devil's Due stuff.
I did too.
Yeah. So and Devil's Due was a direct sequel to the Larry Hama stuff, you know, the Larry Hama Marvel stuff. I know when Hama came back, he just ignored it. Which totally is obviously his want and his right. But as far as like me, the reader, the collector, I was so excited when Devil's Due came out and they picked up and it was the same continuity and they just took it places. I haven't read that stuff in 25 years. So to be frank, I really don't remember a lot of it, but I remember loving it and seeing the further adventures of the characters that I really dug. When I'm sure I will go back to doing Illustrated, so I'll probably start with the Devil's Due. I'll probably go chronologically and just go jump into Devil's Due. But no, I am. Yeah, a little burned out. That's one of the reasons why I'm changing up the format for now and switching to You on Joe a little bit.
You've announced You on Joe a little bit on your podcast. But what exactly are you doing with You on Joe?
Well, it's a work in progress. So I'm finding it as I record, but it's going to be more. It's actually going to be a little bit like this. Thanks for having me on your show, because now I'm going to steal your show.
Perfect.
See, please. This is why I don't listen. No, the concept is I again, it started with the names. I started thinking of fun naming it kind of was driven by that. I was like, what could we do? What could we do? What, something on Joe? Joe on, how can we? And I was like, you on Joe, what would that be?
Sexy.
And I realized, yeah, right. Well, first of all, super sexy. And don't think that I've overlooked that. So that's going to be a part of it. I realized that because of doing Illustrateds, Illustrateds is just me. I don't have a guest on. If there's a guest, it's just a long interview and it's too much for a podcast. And to also break down an issue of a comic book. So I was like, well, I want to get back to actually talking and chatting and interviewing people. So I was like, but how would that be different? I wanted it to do a different spin on it. And so that's when I thought, well, what if I reached out and the people that were on it, formerly my guests were people that I know, and I don't know a lot of Joe friends like in my normal life. So I would introduce them to the cartoon and say, isn't this awesome? And they would love it. And they always had a great time. So now the idea is I want to actually reach out to people like you guys and to people who really love G.I. Joe and say, you on Joe, what is your favorite aspect of G.I. Joe? What is the one thing about G.I. Joe? If you had to narrow it down, I'm sure there's many things, but if you had to narrow it down to one thing, what is that one thing you would want to talk about? And then that's the subject of today's podcast. So we talk about Sergeant Slaughter, and we talk about what you love about Sergeant Slaughter, and that's pretty much it. I try to keep it on that topic. And it could be a 20-minute interview. It could be a 30-minute interview. It could be a 40-minute interview. But we kind of get in. I'm gonna put as much kind of researchy data on it as possible to make it, you know, as knowledgeable as I can. But then, yeah, that's going to be the show. So, you know, we're not going to be doing like the you were saying bits. We're not going to be doing any of that. It's just going to be whatever you want to talk about.
Using Sergeant Slaughter as your example, are we going through and saying, all right, let's talk about all four A-Raw versions of Sergeant Slaughter and the next four versions outside of A-Raw? Or are you just like, what's your favorite version of A-Raw? Let's talk about that.
It's where the conversation goes. Okay. You know, my guest, a good friend of mine, Joey, who just loved Sergeant Slaughter, his most exposure to him was the live action version, you know? And so we talked about that. We talked about him in wrestling and we talked about, you know, what did that mean to him when he was a kid watching this live person also be an action figure, you know? Earlier you mentioned like I'm not the expert in stuff. I am not. I do not know all the deeps and, you know, stuff, but I love it. So what I think I bring to the conversation is a passion and a knowledgeable love, but not an expertise of, well, this specific individual created this character in 1986 named, you know, which is great news to know. But like that stuff, it's not in my brain.
It's in our brains. So
yeah, no. And I love it. And I love it. And that's what your shows, that's what other, you know, shows really excel at. And like all those great Kickstarters, like the stuff like Carson Metaxas does, you know, with like the, all that stuff is, I love it, man. That's the heart. That's what I bring to it of, I love it. I think it's great. It's not in my head. So let's talk about Sergeant Slaughter. We'll just talk about Sergeant Slaughter and wherever the conversation takes us.
I was pitching this to Joel earlier, because you and I have talked about this idea, and we wanted to just bring on people and ask them why they collect, but we never got around to it. And so, just like we said earlier, you beat me in the foot race, and now I'm going to listen to you do this, and I'm going to fucking love it, because that's what we do. Yeah. But I was pitching it to Joel, and I was being like so detailed in trying to pitch it to Joel and like what he really loves about G.I. Joe. And getting really weird and very minutia detailed about it. Your own definition of your show is much more broader and accessible than what I was pitching to Joel. Or maybe I was just wanting Joel to tell you to be on. He wanted to be on and do this super weird deep dive nonsense.
Well, we can do that too. I mean, we can do that. I mean, and that's the thing. I want it to be as minutia. I want it to be as specific as possible. I do, actually. I want it to be, you know, if someone claims, so far no one's claimed Snake Eyes, but like if they do, I'll actually press them and say, which version is it? The cartoon? Is it the, you know, whatever? Because there's so many people that I imagine would love Snake Eyes, but someone like Sergeant Slaughter, that's broad enough. So, you know, so we'll probably just do one show, you know, for now. But strangely, and this was shocking, two people have originally asked for the same topic, and it's not like something like Snake Eyes, like it's a broad topic, but they both asked for the same one. I was like, that's weird, because it is cool. Not. Yeah, it's not like saying, you know, I love the Sunbow. I want to talk about Sunbow. No, it's not that. It's real specific, and I don't want to say what it is. But two people came out right away and were like, I want to do this. I'm like, I went with the guy, first guy who said it. So first one. So
could that be where you bring both on at the same time and the three of you have that conversation?
Ooh, what if it's a debate? That's not a bad idea. Although then that's one less show that I have. So I need to stretch, you know, come on. I love the idea, though.
Did you continue reading? Have you been this 155 and a half to 300?
Yeah. Once I got back into it in whatever year the Devil's Due stuff came out, like 99, I feel like that, maybe 2001 or something. Yeah, whatever. Whenever that started, I've not stopped since. So because I learned my lesson. Because I it was hard for me to track down those last couple issues of G.I. Joe, even though it had only been a couple of years since. Now I know it's really hard to get them. But at the time, I actually had to dig for them. So my lesson was just don't stop reading G.I. Joe and they'll never cancel.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if maybe you had quit and that's why they were moving from IDW. You took 2 months off and then they were like, well, we lost Slepsky. Let's get rid of the brand.
Nope. I'm on board.
Can't pin this one on him.
Nope. I'm not taking that heat anymore. No, it's
someone else's problem.
Mm-hmm.
With 300, did you enjoy the wrap up? Were you surprised?
So this will get into a little bit of review territory like we talked about. So this is my preference. I loved the Snake Eye storyline that they told. I was really happy that he kind of not only reset the board, but actually gave us a better Snake Eyes than we've ever had, you know, face healed and seemingly vocal cords healed. I was disappointed with the cliffhanger. And so far, not that I needed everything wrapped up, but that it seems like just a run of the mill cliffhanger. You know, for the final issue of a publisher, it's real pedestrian. You know, it's one C-130 with six Joes in it, you know, about to crash, six important Joes that we know they wouldn't never kill off, about to crash on a beach. There's no real resolution to anything. Like I would have, to be honest, I really would have expected something more like what they did with 155, where they shuttered the team, you know, not saying they should repeat it, but you know, Devil's Due did the World War III, right? The big Cobra, you know, they knew they were losing the license. So they did a big bang.
It's a whimper instead of a bang.
It's a real whimper. Yeah. It's a real whimper.
I was disappointed that with the lead in of changing Serpentor from Serpentor to more Genghis Khan heavy, that Larry didn't write the ship that he has vocally said needs to be changed and use that same technology to make Snake Eyes Asian.
Oh, interesting.
Because I saw it coming, you know, a few issues before 300. I knew it was going to happen, but with Genghis Khan Serpentor, I really was expecting him to course correct Snake Eyes.
Interesting.
And he could have done it with the technology. It was all explained right there with Serpentor Khan, which I think is a silly name. But instead we got...
But then
he's not really Snake Eyes, but...
Yeah, really. Yeah, but I don't mean that in the Snake Eyes way. I mean that in the continuity way.
Yes.
He wouldn't have been the same person.
Correct.
You know?
And well, at this point, like, that's kind of the debate of, is he the same person? Because when was the last time he was backed up? Until they sit...
Right.
Until they sit him down in a chair with both Dawn and Sean.
Right.
To data dump from them back into him. He's not caught up. He's not.
Exactly.
You know, it's like bringing back grandma dead from 83.
Which could make for very interesting stories if they pick it up like that. If they just go forward and say, oh no, this is just Snake Eyes, and they don't explore that lapse of memory, a lapse of gap, then it seems like a wasted effort. I don't mean to bring up the worst Star Wars movie, but Rise of Skywalker, when they rebooted C-3PO, just leave him rebooted.
Yeah.
Like they had R2 at the very end. They had R2 redo his memory. No, man. Have that be his sacrifice. Just reboot C-3PO and put him back to where he was pre-New Hope or whatever, you know, like whatever date. Maybe you lock it at Empire or lock it at Jedi, whatever year you want to lock it at. But that's the cost. And he should have just stayed that. But then at the last few minutes of that movie, they have R2-D2 restore his memories, and it's just like, well, then what's the point? There's no sacrifice there. So that's interesting. I didn't think about that, making the Asian thing. Yeah, I feel like that's something you address in just a reboot of the series, which they did in the movie, essentially.
Sure.
I was more put out by the general cliffhanger thing. And I don't need those robots.
No, not even a little bit.
Not at all. I was hoping when I saw them pop back up in the last couple issues, my hope was that somehow this would lead to them just like dying, you know, whatever. Yes. And literally someone going like, we will. Poochie went home to his home planet. And Poochie died, and we'll never see Poochie yes. again. That's what I was hoping would happen with them. But the fact that they were even part of the cliffhanger, and they're like hatching plans, I'm like, oh.
They could have been removed. Like, whole cloth just snipped out of the last 10 issues, and it would not have changed the final story arc.
Totally. No one likes them. They're terrible. Just get rid of them. And this would have been a good opportunity. Drop whatever bomb, accidentally drop it on their home planet, and blow them up. And call it a day. Goodbye, Poochie. So that stuff. It didn't feel like IDW was wrapping up any IDW era at all. Especially because the alt Joe verses that they created, which I applaud them for trying. Those all went out with a real whimper too. You know, there was no bang. You know, the Paul Aller stuff, which I thought was real interesting.
Loved it.
That just got canceled. I think that ran into a lot of COVID problems. So to be, you know, real world fair to it. But that just, I wasn't really enjoying that. But then they gave it a double sized wrap up, you know, deluxe format and call it a day. The stuff that Aubrey Citizen was writing, you know, that got all controversied out. And that Scarlet Strike Force just ended with a whimper. And that was literally the end of that Joverse.
I think they should have kept with the Aubrey stuff. I mean, controversy at least was bringing people to the book, bringing eyes to it.
Yeah. At least give us some kind of wrap up for the people that have been reading it for, I think, 15 years.
Yeah.
You know, that started with, you know, the really great stuff that they did with Cobra, you know, the Mike Costa series, Cobra.
Oh, man, this Costa series stuff was great.
Oh, so good. But that's the same universe, right? That's if I'm remembering everything right. And they relaunched the book a few times. I can't keep track of all the various iterations, but it was always still that core alt G.I. Joe universe that was always that I thought they did a really fun job building up, and then it just petered out and they didn't do any. The biggest thing about 300 was the cover, and it's good, be gorgeous cover, and it's great. But that's the big draw. And they're way too slow, way too late in the game with the Saturday Morning Adventures. I enjoyed that miniseries a lot.
I did too.
Regardless of the fact that Joe's never aired on Saturday mornings. But I enjoyed that series a whole lot. Why weren't they doing more of that throughout the years?
It was dumb in all the right spots.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, I enjoyed the G.I. Joe Street Fighter miniseries. Like all that stuff. Like more of that. Yeah, there's more of that. Like more of that. Explore and have fun with the cheekiness of it. Don't be afraid to have fun with G.I. Joe.
Let's end it here. Thanks again for spending time with us discussing toys and other geeky things. Our logo was made by Rhino. The music we use was created by Self Help. You can find Joel on Instagram at Order of Battle Pod. Jason is on Twitter at Order of Battle PD. Our email is orderofbattlepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and thank you for your likes, comments, outreaches, and just being here with us.
This has been the Order of Battle.